The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy O's.
Hi, my name is Shane Terrio, and you are listening to The Riff Raff. Music, stories, and insights from the front line. Hey everybody, thanks for tuning back in to Riff Raff. Back at it with another episode. Yeah, thank you so much for your comments, and I get so many nice emails now. It's like this thing has hit a tipping point or something, I don't know. Sitting here finishing this episode in London, England, which doesn't feel right because it was conducted in Lafayette, Louisiana, but both fine, fine cities. So anyway, let's get to it. My guest today is Mr. Sonny Landreth, and Sonny is a singer, songwriter, and guitar player who, in my opinion, is the most innovative slide guitar player ever. And if you don't give a crap about my opinion, just ask Eric Clapton, Mark Knopfler, Robin Ford, or his many, many legions of guitar fans. I first got hip to Sonny when I got a copy of his record called Outward Bound, which I really love to this day. He's had a really long, successful career as a solo artist. He's got many, many solo records to his name, including the most recent one, Live in Lafayette, which we'll talk about in this podcast. It's a very hip double CD, double record, double whatever it is these days. I've known Sonny for quite a while, and we've done occasional recording sessions together for other people, and he also guested on my solo record Dirty Power on a tune called Mr. Ed. But I didn't know a lot of this stuff you're about to hear. It was really fun getting to pick his brain a bit. So we talk about how he met Hendrix and early influences. He got a Dumble amp. I ask him about all that stuff. You'll hear. So on a weekday, I drove out to Lafayette, Louisiana. It's about 2 hours west of New Orleans. Got stuck in major traffic, all kinds of delays. So I finally walk into the studio. Sonny's longtime engineer, Tony Daigle, standing by, has me all hooked up in a Fender Deluxe, and Sonny's hooked up to his an old Fender basement or something, and plug in and let her rip. So how does somebody from Brobridge, Louisiana, by way of Mississippi, become the most original slide guitar player on the planet? Well, stay tuned and find out. This anyway, so it's...
Man, you're an engineer. You never better than
pull this is live TV, man. Player. This is live TV.
Riff-raff.
Yeah. All right, Sonny. Sounding great as always, man.
We're back at you. This is the afternoon groove.
The afternoon post traffic jam, post getting stuck behind a wide load thing for like 40 miles. So yeah, sorry for my tardiness.
The I-10 hustle. Oh, man. Yeah. We all deal with it, going back and forth to Baton Rouge and Lafayette.
Yeah, you've done it. You're a veteran of that, for sure. You know, it's cool, man. It's taking the drive over here, though. I get to unwind, and I put in Outward Bound, which I haven't heard in years.
Oh, wow.
Love that record.
Neither have I.
Yeah.
Well, cool, man.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites of yours. And I put it, you know, this. I got to tell the people that are listening, there's nothing like listening to Back to Bayou Teche when you're actually crossing Bayou Teche. It's kind of like if you were listening to Wheel in the Sky by Journey and going across like the Golden Gate Bridge or something.
Well, that's cool.
You know what I mean? It's like, probably not. But anyway, man, thanks for doing this, you know, my little hobby here.
And, you bet.
Yeah. I want to just tell the people, let's see, how first time I met you was, it was the Teresa Anderson record.
Oh, right.
I was working
right.
on this
yeah,
Teresa Anderson
right.
record.
That's right.
And she wanted to get a resonator or something. And
yeah.
I was like, I could do it, or we could just call Sonny Landreth.
I'm glad you did. Yeah, that was really awesome. You know, and too, for me, that was the first time I worked with Teresa in any fashion or form. I was just totally blown away with her voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that track we did together, it was, we cut it live. I don't know if you remember
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
I have a little notebook where I jot down an outline, and I started to do that last night, and in all my haste leaving New Orleans this morning, I left it. So
that's okay. We'll just wing it.
We'll wing it. I know enough about you where I can piece something together and some cohesiveness.
You're enough for blackmail. Don't need a notebook for that.
It's good seeing you down here, man, in the motherland. I'm in Brobridge, Louisiana, sitting at Tony Daigle's studio. What is the name of this studio? Is it still Electric Como Land?
Yeah, Electric Como Land.
Tony has he's a great engineer. He's been a friend and engineer of yours for many years.
Yep. We've done a ton of work together and pretty much all of my albums since the mid-90s. He came on board out at Dockside and when I started working out there some years later, and just a lot of great things came together, working with Tony and starting to work with Bobby Charles. And I got Bobby Field out there, my producer back in the BMG days. That would have been 1992 for Outward Bound. You mentioned
R.S. Field. He's great.
Yeah, R.S. Field.
I was wondering who that was.
He's one of a kind, man. A genius, brilliant, and just funny, and he's we did that and South of I-10, so it was my Zoo Praxis BMG days, and but we had a lot of fun, and Tony and I, we worked on all that stuff, and then post after that we done all of my albums since.
Yeah, well, you always get great guitar sounds anywhere, but it's cool to be in here where you cut your stuff, you know. Also, I was thinking about I had to try to learn some of your parts when I was playing with Zachary Richard.
Oh,
and
goodness.
Some of those tunings were really, I couldn't figure them out. There was one, it was like a minor, kind of D minor sort of tuning.
It was like a minor ninth tuning. Yeah,
cool. It really was.
Yeah, Zach, you know, that afforded me the opportunity on those, like on that session with those tracks, but his kind of from his singer-songwriter perspective, just kind of went for something different than I'd done. Because actually back in the early days with Zach in 1980, I had left Clifton Chenier's band out in California. Sounds odd to say that, but I did. And then went to Canada for the first time with Zach. And I had a great band with Craig Leger on keyboards, Shelton Saunier on bass, and Mike Benet on drums, and just four-piece mm-hmm. backup band for him. But the first thing we did is go up to Montreal and cut a live album.
Yeah, live in Montreal.
But we did a lot of rehearsing, playing some gigs locally, and so I really owe that experience to him and sort of turning me loose in the other countries like that. And then exposing me to the way that he played the traditional songs, which he's never done anything. Like, he would always change that up in such a way that was rocking it out more. And it gave me the opportunity to play both straight guitar and slide on those songs. And then later, with his more of a singer-songwriter material, kind of delve into some deeper stuff with the tunings.
Yeah, that was really interesting, because I got to work with him quite a bit, and so I'm familiar with a lot of that stuff. Couldn't figure all of it out. But I remember Zachary told me one time, I asked him about that record, and he said, well, Sonny used to just show up with a little red pedal, which I'm assuming was a Dynacomp.
Yeah, it was a Dynacomp. Yeah, that was it, pretty much.
Really?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I had my Gibson Firebird, 64 Firebird, and from that I went into the Dynacomp, and the Dynacomp into Echoplex, and the Echoplex into the 50-watt Marshall head, early 70s. It got stolen at Grant Street many years later. And through, through one of these.
That Fender.
Two of these Bandmaster cabs, and one of them had JBL 12s and of all things.
Oh, yeah, man.
And that's what I used to play through. That's all I played through. In fact, that's what I cut, that Live in Montreal album, and a lot of the other, we did some tracks in Bogalusa for that album. Then my 50-watt got stolen. Bought 100-watt.
And Zachary was a guest on this, and I actually played a track from him. He talked about you for a few minutes, and I played some stuff from that record.
Attention, parce que ça c'est la territoire de Tonton Grigri.
So I didn't know. I knew you were with Clifton Chenier. I didn't know if that was before Zach or after Zach. So that was before.
It was right before. Yeah, I started playing with Clifton in '79. Played with him for about a little over a year, and then segued into playing with Zach. And but then I would go back and play with Cliff off and on for like three and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
His health was really failing him at that point, unfortunately. But I got in on the tail end of that, but before it got really bad for him. And he played when he started playing again after his surgery, they had to operate on him and he was on dialysis, but he couldn't play accordion yet, so he had his cousin playing accordion, and Cliff played harp.
Wow.
He played harp and sang. It was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And killer band, of course. So that was really my education.
That was school.
Huh? Yeah, that was school for me. That's the best schooling I ever had.
Yeah, I'll bet, man. And when your style, I mean, I know you've probably done a ton of interviews and talked about this, but listening Outward Bound and stuff, man, it's so you. I mean, you come up, you've got this whole, like, how does somebody from Brobridge, Louisiana become one of the most recognizable slide? I mean, because really, I would say we're friends and stuff, but all that aside, man, your sound is like, you hear one note, you know it's you. Like, how'd you come up with that vocabulary? I mean, did the accordion influence your...
Yeah, sure.
Because I can think, hear, like, where you're kind of emulating maybe some of the...
A lot of, like, the instrumentation in the area. I actually started out on trumpet. That was my first instrument, and I played that through... That was my academic instrument and through high school and college, which was great because then when I started playing guitar, I would have been 13, my first guitar, really came at it with a different perspective, I think. Thinking more like a wind instrument player, where you have to take a breath, and it's more that phrasing involved. So looking back on it, I think that was good for me. And then I had exposure to classical and jazz and, you know, like stage music and reading and writing.
Just enough theory.
Trying to learn dynamics, enough to get me into trouble. By
yeah, right.
But I had, and I loved all kinds of music. And growing up here and with the Cajun Zydeco, and we'd go to New Orleans when I was a lot. My dad actually graduated from Tulane way, way back ago. And so that's when I first heard jazz and R&B and second line. So this, as you know, the wonderful thing about living here, and particularly to be raised here, the culture is so strong and music is such a big part of that identity. And I didn't know any different. I mean, it's just the way it was here. And I think by osmosis or, the humidity or the gumbo or all the above, something. Right. It all, you take all that in. And what's great about that, when you're a kid, you don't have any preconceived notions. So it's a clean slate, and you're just assimilating all of that. So that by the time I did started approaching the slide, then I had a way to, I don't know if it makes any sense, but a way to crystallize all that.
Yeah.
Because I felt comfortable with different, playing in different styles and different genres, but that's a good thing, and it's also, you can get scattered. You can get in too many directions at once. And I always wanted to write my own songs, and I always wanted to have my own sound. Mm. So that helped me to pull all that together in a more uniform fashion in terms of using chordal tunings, open tunings, learned listening to.
I mean, because there's nobody that I know of around here. You know, I grew up not that far away from here, but I don't. It's amazing that it's not like, you know, they had anybody that sounded anything like what you sound like. Yeah, I don't hear any derivative things like,
well,
Dwayne,
you know what?
Allman,
it's interesting you
kind of
should say that, because I think that too helped me. The fact that there wasn't anybody, there were no great slide guitar players that I looked up to. I mean, certainly there were tons of heroes on records.
Sure.
Listening to records. But there wasn't anyone I could go out and hear. And at that point, in my late teens, I was very adventurous, as we all were. And back in those days, long before being able to go online and pull up anything, you had to go find that person and listen to him on a gig. And I met B.B. King, I met Clifton Chenier, and I met Jimi Hendrix all within a little over a year.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Where'd you meet Hendrix at?
In Baton Rouge.
Wow.
First, and I read about B.B. and others, you know, the great bluesmen, through these interviews with Eric Clapton.
Mm-hmm.
I was a big Eric Clapton fan by then, and he would talk about them in his interviews, and then I noticed, wow, B.B. King's playing in New Iberia. It's like 20 miles south of Lafayette. There's a little club called Leo's Rendezvous, and he was still doing the Chitlin' circuit, basically. So I went down there with a friend of mine, and it just blew my mind. And then he took a break, and he was sitting at the bar, which is literally about 15 feet from the bandstand. And he was playing for as if he'd been 20,000 people in there, you know. It's a little black club, and they loved him, but there weren't a lot of people in there.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went up and started talking to him, And that's kind of what happened with Clifton. I heard about this guy that played blues on the accordion, and I couldn't imagine that. Accordion to me was like, you know, I never would have put the two together. So
was it a Cajun accordion or a big zydeco?
Well, no, a piano accordion.
Okay.
Yeah, he played the big piano accordion. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was his
chromatic
thing. And that was, I think, a part of his sound was so big, and had he was always changing the, you know, stops up and getting different harmonics.
Yeah,
and
like a B3 or something.
Yeah, draw really, bars. He really did. And he, anyway, so he saw us at the door, and only two white kids there. It was at the Blue Angel Club, which was kind of his headquarters. It was down the street from his house. Years later, when I would play with him, that's the only way I ever found out anything that was going on with the band. I never knew where these places were we were going to play. I'd call up the Blue Angel, and the manager would tell me where we were playing and how to get there. I'm in the middle of a cane field, you know, north of Opelousas or something. But that's how I met Clifton, and the same thing happened with Hendrix in Baton Rouge. My buddies and I went over early during the day and trying to find him, and we did. He was in a hotel right next to the venue, which was Independence Hall, and he was upstairs. He had a reel-to-reel tape player going, and what later I think sounded like some of the tracks on Electric Ladyland. This would have been in 68.
Wow.
So this big English road manager, whoever, runs us all off, and we're two of us were hiding in the gift shop. And then walks Hendrix. He came in to buy like a toothbrush and get some toothpaste or something. So we go, well, here we go.
Yeah.
Here I go again. So we walk up to Hendrix and introduce ourselves. It's pretty classic. But I think those experiences.
How
like
was
that,
it? Was he cool?
He was totally cool, but he was pretty out of it, man. He was standing there. He's like, his hair is all messed up. And the thing that surprised me, he wasn't as tall as I thought he was going to be.
Yeah.
But his fingers were so long. When I shook his hand, I couldn't believe how long his fingers were. And so I didn't know what to say. I just popped out of my, you know, in my head and out of my mouth. I said, well, what did I say? Somebody, tell us, Jimmy, what is Axis Bold as love? And so he's like, he had his tooth, he held his hand up over his head, like with a toothbrush and toothpaste in it. Oh man, it's kind of like the love for a man.
He's just making
a woman
it up,
and
totally making everything up.
And it's, I don't know, man. I just woke up and walks off. And so that was my early lesson. Getting a good behind the scenes picture of living on the road. Yeah. Because, of course, at that age, you glorify the whole thing.
Wow.
And I got to be friends with Noel Redding many years later, and he well remembered that gig. And Jimmy didn't know that he was supposed to play two shows that night, so he wasn't real happy about that. And then some of the people in the audience were jerks. And
I mean, how long were the shows back then? Like 30 minutes or something?
Well, he played the first show. He played longer. The second show, maybe 45 minutes, because he got pissed, and then he walked off stage, but. It was still enough to blow my mind.
I used to see Mitch Mitchell, and I used to see Noel Redding too, but Mitch Mitchell used to have Cartage in Nashville, and I used to have my stuff at this Cartage place. And I'd go in to get an amp or something, and I'd see the drums. Mitch Mitchell would be like, wow, but I never saw him. I didn't really know him. And one day he was there, and some guy was like garming him hard and asking him all these Hendrix stuff, and he was trying to be patient. And then basically he cut the guy off. He goes, listen, from 68 through this, he goes, I don't remember anything. He goes, I don't remember anything. I'm sorry. It's completely gone.
It's gone. Yeah. Well, you can understand that, you know, hearing the stories.
This morning people, they ran for my shoes.
You know I had the mean old walking blues. Woke up this morning, looked around for my shoes.
Yeah, so I really, coming back to that, I didn't really have any, there wasn't like a master slide guitar player around that I could go study. So I think that really helped me. It pushed me to kind of find my own identity. And by hearing B.B. King and Hendrix and Clifton and listening to a lot of music all the time, mm-hmm. just checking other musicians out. And it's a really formative point in a kid's life. And I think that, in the big picture, helped me to find my own way. Because then I was working in a music store, a local music store, Prof Ernie's.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I grew up in that store, basically, which was great for me, exposure to everything that was happening. All the band directors would go there to buy their music. They had albums. They had 45s. They had all the band instruments. They had a room full of guitars. And they had a kid, Raymond Deku, he was going to be a senior in high school, and I was going to be a freshman. It was that summer before. And he's the one that taught me how to play Chet Atkins style. You see, have you ever heard of Chet Atkins? I said, well, yeah, I've heard of him. And he sits down, and he starts playing these
solo pieces.
So that's
where the thumb pick came in?
That's what all of this mm-hmm. stuff, the right-hand technique mm-hmm. is totally from what Raymond showed me how to do, play Chet Atkins songs. And then I would tackle one of the songs and then play for him, a couple days later. And I was just trying to get that, that going.
Yeah, the independent bass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, trying to get that going.
That's hard to do, man.
Yeah, and I'd never done anything like that before, And so I'd work on it, and he'd check me out. He'd give me pointers. And then I just dove headlong into
that. I didn't
know
you were into Chet like that.
Oh, yeah, big time.
Did you ever get the Yankee Doodle Dixie thing?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, and that was my first greatest accomplishment on the guitar.
I remember seeing...
Because he played that.
Yeah.
He played for me, and I went, I watched two songs at the same time.
You know? Oh, yeah. And then Chet used to say, well, tonight Dixie's going to be on the low strings.
Yeah.
And, it's just amazing how he could do that. I never...
Yeah, that was a big... But what was great, it taught me solo guitar, thinking in terms of multiple parts, like a melody, bass part and a rhythm and all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And to think like that. But up until then, I hadn't, it was all like try to play lead or learn chords, but not something on that level. So by the time I started listening to the Delta Cats, Delta Bluesmen, and that's the way I heard that. I said, oh, well, I could take that thumb style approach, finger style, the Chets. And when I started working with the slide for the left hand, and it's kind of putting the two of those together that really helped to set me on my way. And from that point on, that's when I started kind of take everything in and interpret it in that light.
I didn't know any of this stuff. It's pretty interesting. Yeah, I didn't know anything about Chet. I'm quoting from Outward Bound because I had that in the car today, but a lot of people know you particular for your slide playing, but there's a lot of single note stuff on that record too, man. I mean, there's some great solos on there. Who are some of your influences? I mean, I think you said Ry Cooder one time. You liked Ry Cooder.
Yeah, Ry Cooder.
But just for single note stuff too. I mean, who else did you listen to?
Well, like with flat pick, the straight playing and all. Yeah, BB was big. Also, Wes Montgomery. I was a big Wes Montgomery fan. I never could get it, but it sometimes when it's something that's complex and so incredible like that, you may not be able to play it, but it informs you somehow that you turn that into something else. And I did a lot of that because I never could really play like anybody else. I never to my satisfaction. But Michael Bloomfield was big into him when he came out on the scene. The good thing about playing in a band with older kids, they were already into stuff I didn't know about, and they were turning me on to all these great players back in the 60s. And then they had the New Orleans Pop Festival, which was actually outside of Gonzales, and then all these the great bands of the day, a lot of them played on that. Chicago Transit Authority, before they were Chicago, Janis Joplin, Airplane, The Dead, The Birds of Clarence White.
Wow.
That's the first time I heard Clarence White, and that blew my mind. All these great groups. But so all of those guitar players, you know, I was hearing, picking up on all of that. So my single note work came from, I think, hearing how they did that. And at the same time, I was still influenced by my jazz heroes like Miles Davis and Coltrane and Ornette Coleman. Was into all the big band stuff with Basie. I got to hear Count Basie and Duke Ellington. Another great thing about being close to New Orleans.
Yeah, it's really...
It was a long time ago, you know, so they were still at it. And but the fact that with the wind instrument players thinking, wanting to emulate the human voice with their instrument. So when I would hear somebody like Bloomfield or Johnny Winter, and we heard about him, and had to go drive to Texas to hear him play, and you know, all of these were life-changing moments.
Yeah.
Then I would think like a wind instrument player, how it would take that sort of like their style, but how, you know, still phrasing-wise, I think that I recognized later that my blues heroes and my jazz heroes were all striving to do the same thing, to emulate the human voice with their instrument. And I think that was the thing that caught me so much with slide guitar, because it even more so to my ear, there was that lyrical vocal quality about it.
Mm-hmm. That makes total sense. Something.
Can I play something else?
Yeah, let me. Now I have a new cable. Let me see.
Yeah, you got a new cable, new improved.
Got a lot of presence now. This. Should we stay in G, or you want to play something different?
It doesn't matter. We can get something else. I can retune or just.
No, I'm just thinking something.
D? Something D. E.
Before we start, I want to ask you, when you hit those notes, those real high, like you swell up to these notes and they just sing, like I mean how do you get that thing to just swell like that?
Well, with the slide, you know, because of the fact that, you know, the frets aren't choking it out, but it's and it's heavier gauge too, 13 to 56.
Well, I mean, I have all that stuff too. It doesn't sound like that. I mean, I know all that stuff. I'm just, it's just this thing you have.
Man,
it's like
a thing. It's a feel thing where you.
Yeah, like it blooms, you know, at a certain point.
So what I'm doing is here. If I didn't use anything back behind the slide.
Mm-hmm. So you're lifting your index and middle finger off. Yeah, it's
sort of... So you lift it enough that you... See, this third finger's not really touching that string. It's helping to control the motion and for intonation.
Yeah.
Back sort of anchoring. Like, it's kind of... It goes with the slide a lot. I use that finger and the slide together, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So my third finger, my fourth finger are... a bit synonymous, as it were, in motion.
They can't see, so the slides on your pinky.
So that way you can you can mute behind the slide like that, just with one finger. But what you're catching is this.
Yeah. And then you also sort of invented that behind the slide technique too, where you.
This.
Yeah,
I was doing I'm tuned to minor right now, but that was what happened. I could see the notes back there.
Get all the extensions and things.
So that's a combination. I have three strings that are the floating with the slide.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, what I just played. And I'm reaching back behind the slide, the fret, so that way the string goes underneath.
Right.
And you have a combination of one fretted note, in this case, I'm in G, so that's an F. And then here's a G. There's a D. There's another G. With a high D on top. But that helps get that sustain. You just lift it enough that you get it makes a more complex sound.
Absolutely.
Just, and just have to let it soar. You know,
that's what I'm talking about. It just has this. It just sort of peaks, and it's got this beautiful.
Yeah, you
want to
have a bloom on it, and that's part of that getting back to the. Vocal quality, that I love so much about playing slide.
And you also do this thing where you take your palm, and I could never figure that out. Yeah, how the hell do you do that?
Well, what happens is the fact that it would not occur to someone that's playing standard guitar because your strings are the range of motion. Are dictated by placing, fretting the string. So there's no distance really between the string and the fret, if you follow what I'm saying. With slide, those notes, I just did all that without touching any frets. Mm-hmm. So there's that distance between the slide and the notes that are floating and the fretboard. So what that means, you can actually push on it. More than you would think. There's that range in between the top, it would be the bottom of the string, if you follow what I'm saying, and the actual fretboard, that you can push on the strings, and you're not going to... It's not going to break. It's not going to hurt it. And you can control those harmonics on the backside as well. So you can control the speed, intensity, and
tremolo.
How many harmonics you pick up with it changes. It's kind of like
it looks really trippy too to watch it. It looks like it doesn't look like you can actually. Yeah, because I'm thinking more fretted technique.
Yeah, and that's the difference. And it gives you that the potential to create those sounds because of the distance in between the string and the fretboard and. It really opens up a whole lot more harmonically, and you can add a lot of cool colors to a track. And really, it kind of all gets back to the Delta bluesmen and their story songs, because they would use the guitar and the slide in particular to reinforce the lyric of the song, so that whatever they were singing about, they would emulate that, the train or whistle or the wind or whatever. And that got me to thinking about the guitar in terms of concept, really like creating a soundtrack for each song. Because much as geeky as we are about guitar and gear, it all comes down to serving the song. Mm-hmm. And that's what I love about working with people on their projects, you know, and I always want to know what the song's about, you know, get the lyric sheet, and then that helps me to think in terms of coloring, coloring and helping in a way to bring something to the table that wasn't there before with some of these techniques.
You know. Yeah, well, that's a lot of that is just all you, man. I've never heard anybody do anything like that, some of those things. Well, let's play something.
Play something. Yeah, D.
Give me a progression.
Yeah, go ahead. You
I don't
pick
know.
Something.
I'm just in D. You want to like a. What tuning is that? So is that just a
well?
D
I'm in. I tuned to G minor.
G minor. Okay.
But I'm just playing on a D position.
It's like cross harp or something.
Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah, I like doing that too. And a lot of times, for example, tune to G and then play an A.
Yeah.
Or any third position for C and F, and. Around here, you know, a lot of the old school cats, like, say, if you're playing with Little Buck Senegal, and my hero and my mentor, he played guitar in all the heyday, the many years with Clifton Chenier, and just badass, man, just badass plug-in.
Was he in the Little Band of Gold?
Yeah, well, no, he's not in the Little Band of Gold, but he plays with Charles Adcock a lot. I mean, they do projects together. Charles is such a big fan of Little Buck's, too, and we kind of all grew up hearing him, and But he's just got a way, man. He's got his tone and phrasing. But he plays, I was going to say, he plays a lot of the horn keys. Because he came up in horn bands.
B-flat, E-flat,
E-flat, E-flat, and F, and so forth. Like Doc, you know, like Mac like Mac does Dr. John.
Yeah.
You know, you think like horn players a lot. And I love that. So it's good for me. It keeps me on my toes.
Even yeah.
If I'm tuned to A and I'm playing in B flat or whatever, it's kind of good for me to
mm-hmm.
get out of my comfort zone a little bit.
I don't know if it's true, but I heard the story. Maybe it was CC, the guy you're talking about. For those that don't know, Charles Atcott, people call him CC Atcott.
Yeah, he's great.
He used to play with Buckwheat, right?
Oh yeah, he had. Yeah, he played.
I had heard
Buckwheat
that
too.
He had. I don't know if this is a true story, but it's a funny story. He said, maybe it was Zachary told me this, that one day the band called him in and said, "CC, Buckwheat wants to see you in the dressing room," you know, and it was like an intervention type thing.
Oh, this sounds good already.
Yeah, and they were like, "Oh man," like, I don't, you know, and CC's like the only white dude in the band. He's like, "Man, I don't know what I did wrong," you know. So they're like, "Yeah, he wants to see you in the dressing room." So he walks in, and the whole band's there, and they're like all staring at the floor, kind of thing, like total intervention. He's like, and Buckwheat goes, "CC, sit down. We got to talk to you about your that addiction problem." And he's like, "Well, I don't know what you talk about, Buckwheat." And he's like, "Yeah, I don't even drink. I didn't do anything." He goes, "It's that little blue pedal you keep playing." He goes, "You addicted to that?" And it was a chorus pedal. He goes, "You're using that on every song. You got to get rid of that. You're addicted to that.
You're addicted to that." Oh, I can just hear him.
It's got to be true. I forget who told me that. Maybe
I'm
going
to ask him. It's too good to not be true. Yeah. I mean, all the potential elements are, you know.
It's got to right. Speaking. You know all those people, yeah. So it's got to be real. Well, anyway, you know what else I wanted to ask you, too, before I forget, because I don't have my little cheat sheet, Sonny. You have a Dumble amplifier, which that's another thing people are never going to let me live down if I don't ask you about that. How did you acquire a Dumble? Because, you know, nowadays you could buy probably a house in this neighborhood with that amp.
Yeah, easily. Yeah, you could. I thought about it, too. No.
I mean, back in the day, I mean, they were still expensive, right?
Yeah, they've always been expensive for their time, you know, for the time in the period. But now, just through, you know, in the stratosphere. I met Alexander through my friend Stephen Bruton. And I had a gig at Grant Street, a few blocks away from here. And that was my haunt. That's where my hang. I used to play there all the time. And all the great blues acts came through, and R&B, and all the cool, you know, soulful stuff. But anyway, we were playing, and Stephen wanted to start playing over here, and so we set it up for him to, he and his band, to open up. And he had his Dumble, and he said, "Man, you got to try this amp out." So I went over and I plugged it in. I started playing, and I went, "Oh shit, yeah, man!" He's showing me how, because it was a bit a little intimidating at first with an amp. You don't know how it works, and that one in particular is really unique, and there's never been anything like it. The signal path and how everything works, and different components of that amp, and there's a reason for everything, and it's just to follow the signal path and what happens and what you can do with it. So it took me a little while to, you know, I just went with what Stephen had dialed in, and so next thing I know, I'm out at Dockside working on some tracks, and there's a phone call. I go upstairs in the kitchen, and it's Dumble.
Wow.
So Alexander calls, and I think what had happened is I gave Stephen a copy of Outward Bound, and he gave it to Alexander. And Alexander said something like, "I was listening to your CD, and I thought to myself, now there's a man who can use an overdrive special. He'll know what to do with it." So, well, there's only one way to find that out. But that's how I met him, and I would go out to L.A. And go hang with him. Steve and I used to go hang out with him all the time, and if I was in the city, I'd go hang with him, go eat dinner, and go hang at his place. It was great, man. I loved it. He's just always been a great, great guy and a good friend to me. And we'd start going to the lab, is what I called it. It was so full of gear and stuff, and start trying things. And then I was playing a gig in Nashville. By then, this would have been 95. And there was a Dumble combo that I played through. It was at the rental hall that we would practice, you know, rehearse at and, mm-hmm. and so forth. And so I told him about that one, and he knew the serial number. I mean, he knew everywhere every one of them was.
Yeah.
So he patterned mine. We started with that as a blueprint, and then I'd go over, and then he would tweak it. I would play it, and he would tweak it. Then once, I guess that was, yeah, that had to be a little later in 95. I got mine, and I had it out. That's all I played. And he built a 2x12 cab for me. He does all it by hand. I mean, everything. And both Steven and I, over the years, would try to approach Alexander on the idea of getting someone else to build them for him so he wouldn't be so hard on him. He could sell more, you know. But he just couldn't give it up. And I actually appreciated that.
Yeah.
I mean, he was so meticulous about everything. You know, like people would say, well, they opened him and they found a Radio Shack part in there.
Right.
If he had a Radio Shack part in there, it was right next to something else for a reason. I mean, you know.
You just listen to him. Yeah. It's
just that, you know, there are no Radio Shack parts of mine. But, I mean, he was always, he had all these, he had this, just like a manuals of that he had written of different mods and circuitry, and he just had a ton of them. You know, people think of the Dumble sound, but really it's far more evolved than even that, because he, in particular, he would custom tailor the way he tweaked the amp to the player. That's what why he liked for you to come in and to do that. And when my friend Tommy Como, when I introduced them, he wouldn't build an amp for him until Tommy went over there and played for him.
Mm.
He had to kind of audition.
He had to audition to see if he was up to it. Yeah,
yeah, and he passed, of course, Flying Colors, and then they became friends. And then
it's like getting a Japanese sword made by the master. Right. It's like, exactly. Oh, I got to see your skills first. Exactly. You know?
But but it's an amazing amp. I mean, it's really different than any other.
You know, when we did that session together for Joel, you had your Demeter, and I loved the sound of that thing, man.
Yeah, me too. I got that one. I met him when I was out with John Hyde on the early. It was like the second year we were out on the road with him, so he built it for me. It was right at the end of '89, and I'd go to his shop and try his amps. I actually met him through David Lindley.
Wow.
And David had played these songs. It was a demo that he did with Hyatt. And then later we recut those songs. It became Slow Turning, that album.
I want to ask you, I mean, maybe it's a good way to segue into this, because I don't want to talk about gear the whole time. I want to find out how you got the gig with Hyatt. Like, was that through Lindley?
Well, no, actually, the one that I owe that to is Ray Benson of Asleep at the Wheel.
Wow, man, I didn't know any of this stuff.
Yeah, he was doing production where he was producing Darden Smith, a really talented, gifted singer-songwriter in Austin, Texas. And so Ray calls me up, and then... I think I actually drove out there, drove to Austin to play on the album. And I was out in the studio, and we're working on this track. And Ray had said, you know, John Hyatt? Said, he's looking for a band. He's got a new album out. Rakuta played on it. I said, well, I've never met him, but yeah, I've heard some of the songs, you know. And great, you know. But I'm out there tuning my guitar. The next thing I know, he's handing me the phone. And, of course, this is back. You know, when you still had to be plugged into something, he stretched the phone all the way out from the studio.
Yeah.
And he had Hyatt on the phone.
Wow.
Like, so John has on the phone, he wants to talk to you. And I know he just put us both on the spot. You know, okay.
Awkward.
Sure, if you want to come, I'm doing auditions. And next thing I know, the next day, they're helping me get packed up. And I didn't even have a suitcase. I had to put my clothes in a trash bag, which they call the Cajun suitcase in the parking lot.
I've heard it called other things, but that's a good one, a Cajun suitcase. My friend from Germany used to call it a Turkish suitcase.
There you go. But and every culture
offend everyone.
A,
yeah, but anyway,
a slap in the
so
face.
So you went straight from Austin to Nashville.
I went to Nashville, did the audition, got the gig, went back to Austin, finished the session, went home, and then I had the album, Bring the Family. So I'm listening to the album and start learning the songs, and I go, and I've never done anything like this. So I called John up, and I told him, I said, I've never done this before, but I'm going to tell you, I know the band you want to have. And he goes, really? Because he's still auditioning bass players mm-hmm. and drummers. And I said, yeah, there's David Ranson, who plays bass with me. We've been playing together for a long time. And Kenneth Blevins on drums. Mm-hmm. Played with us in and out over the years. And another good friend. So next thing I know, the three of us are flying. I'm going back to Nashville and go with Kenneth and Dave. So we, you know, introduced, I guess it was SIR and rehearsal hall. And so I introduced them to John and they had the equipment set up. And we get up on stage and goes, well, okay. Well, how about Memphis in the meantime? So Kenneth counts it off, play Memphis in the meantime. I mean, as soon as we stopped, he said, that's it. Cancel the auditions, you know.
Wow.
This is it. You know, the chemistry, you know.
Yeah.
This is what we all knew was something special.
Sure.
You know? And it wasn't, but maybe 15 years, 20 years later, Kenneth told me that, you know, Memphis in the Meantime was the first song on the, because I got them all the album, you know, uh-huh. they sent them the album, actually. And it's the first song on the album, and that's the only one he listened to.
It was meant to be. And Kenny's still there.
Yeah, but it
He's
wouldn't
still
have mattered.
Playing with him, right?
It wouldn't have mattered. Yeah, you know, when you hear Jim Keltner, I mean, I think of Jim Keltner, yeah. and I think of, you know, the greatest in the world, and that's Kenneth.
Absolutely.
He's one of the greatest in the world.
Great,
he's
man.
Just,
yeah. I know that beat.
Yeah. Not anybody can just jump in on that, man. That narrows the field considerably.
Kenny is such a great player, man. I've got to play with him quite a bit, and with Zachary live at this down here in Lafayette, and live, I think it was Festival of Acadiana.
I think it was. Yeah, I think you guys did that.
It's like
that,
a
yeah.
train, man. Once he gets going.
Well, he's truly one of the greatest drummers I have ever worked with, and he's such a stylist, and he's just. Got that loosey goosey rock. I mean, it's just everything feels right. Yep. The grease is there. He was always one of our favorite drummers here when I first time I ever played with him back in the 70s. And then he moved to New Orleans and started hanging out with Johnny V and Johnny Vodakovich. And that's he studied under him. Mm-hmm. That was his kind of his mentor. And then that's when he began to master the second line, you know.
But he's still got the power and the edge.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable.
It's a perfect,
yeah,
deadly
combination. So with him and Dave on bass, that was...
So who titled the band The Goners? Was that high?
What John did, his first name was The Wishbags, and we nixed that one.
That sounds like some old like English beat thing or something.
Okay, what do you think about this? John Hyde and The Wishbags, and I just remember dead silence and... let's come up with something
you're down
else.
John Hyde, man. You're a lot more creative than that.
And then he came up with The Goners, and then we went, yeah, I like that. That's kind of cool. And then, lo and behold, there was Goners out in California somewhere, so he had to buy...
The new originals.
Yeah,
the original.
He had to buy the name from them.
Oh, he did?
That's probably, yeah. You know, start thinking about that. Bands I played in, if anybody had ever bought the name, probably been the most money we ever made.
I've only met him once. I met Hyatt once in New York. I did that TV thing, Sessions at West 54th one time, and he was...
Yeah, we did that.
He was a host, guest host, and he was cool.
Yeah.
He was really cool. And
yeah,
I told him I was
a
big, you know, Little Village fan. I don't know if that was the right thing to say, but he seemed really nice. But I've heard that he can be a bit cantankerous at times.
Well, yeah, he especially in the old days, you know. He had a rough time... growing up and later in life, and plus he was well known as addictions, you know, and he overcame all that. And when we started playing together, man, he had just cleaned up and entered the program, and he never fell off the wagon. Mm.
and that was 1987.
That was around, that was before Little Village.
Oh, yeah.
Because Keltner actually told me the reason it all imploded was...
Yeah, well, that was...
Cooter and I, and it was in Nashville. He said it was in Nashville. It was,
yeah, there was a history there. Well, when they did, what happened is they made the album Bring the Family. So then when John gets ready to go on the road, he's on the label, he had to have a band. So that's how we came about. Mm. So the first year, all we did is literally play the Bring the Family album and any other of the, you know, millions of songs that John had already written by then. His catalog was so deep even way back then. And he was such a critic's darling from that particular album. So everyone came out. Well, who's he going to have in the band? You know, we had Ry Cooter, Jim Keltner, and Nick Lowe. It was right. His band. And they cut that album just in a few days.
Yeah.
It just did it, winged it. You know, John showed him the songs. You know, any kind of little flubs, they kept it. And there was a charm about all that.
And John Shalhoub, remember John Shalhoub?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
We worked on that thing
with
Joel.
Yeah, we did that same thing.
He passed away last year.
Yeah, a lot of them
have. He's sort of an eclectic character.
But you have to give him credit, you know,
he
brought
it together.
And so that's the thing about that. So by the time you're talking with Little Village, they were trying to kind of recreate that, and there was already enough, I think, history and agenda, you know. But still, I mean, I can tell you, I mean, John's a huge fan of Rise, because he actually, that's how they met. John played in Rise band.
Wow.
Yeah, it all predates all of this stuff we're talking about. And even though there was whatever conflicts later, creative things or whatever, that he still, you know, we would listen to him in a band driving across the country. Back in the day, we all took turns driving, you know, first year. We did that here in the U.S. for a couple of months, and then went to Europe for 2 months, did the same thing.
I was going to say, that's probably the first gig besides Zach that got you out of Bridge more internationally, because I'm sure you were playing Europe all the time.
Yeah, we did. And with Zach was the first time I played in Europe, like in France and in Belgium, and of course in Canada and Quebec. But with John, we literally, you know, we got the itinerary. We got all excited because we'd never been to Switzerland and Austria and all these places. And back then, of course, it was before the EU and all that. And so you had to stop at every single border with a carnate for the crew, which means they'd have a list of all the equipment, and they'd go through everything, and it was just a huge deal. And you had to exchange money and every time. When they dropped the borders, it was a good thing.
Yeah.
My first tour going back over there without any borders like that was awesome. But, so he and John, I have to thank because of the attention and focus on him, you know, from that album worldwide, then the focus was on the band.
Right.
And frankly, I mean, we just went out and there was nothing like what we had out there. I mean, Rolling Stone, all the magazines came out. I mean, everybody. And we just whooped ass.
Not only were you kicking ass, it was the mystique of having like a South Louisiana
nobody
band.
Knew who we were.
It was like cool.
I think one of them described me as a cigar store Indian who just stands there emotionless.
That's bullshit right there, it sounds like.
But, you know, that actually helped me. So John introduced me really to the world in that regard and for my career. I mean, I've never had that kind of exposure. Let's go to Memphis in the meantime, baby. Memphis in the meantime, girl. Just need a little shot of that rhythm, baby. Mix up with these country blues. I wanna trade in these old cowboy boots for some fine Italian shoes. Forget the boots and the hairspray, sugar, we don't need none of that. Now a little dab, gonna do your darling underneath the pork pie hat.
So you got time just for a couple more minutes?
Sure, man.
Yeah, all right. So Sonny just handed me this record, Live in Lafayette. Now, you've done Live in Lafayette one time before.
Well, we did, Grant Street Grant was Street. Our first official live album. That's been, like 11 years ago.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. Yeah.
So, this seemed like really a good cool. time to
a double CD, man. Again. Wow, I haven't seen one of these in a while.
Well, I know,
time.
It's double. And here's the thing. Half of it is acoustic and half is electric.
Ah, okay.
I couldn't decide what to do, to be honest. Should I do an acoustic album? I've been thinking about doing that for a long time. I know a lot of the fans wanted it. I wanted to still document some of our trio work with Dave and Brian and I. And I wanted to have some guests, but I wanted it with Steve Kahn on keyboards and Sam Broussard on guitar. He and I came up in the same neighborhood just few blocks down the road here. He's incredible. They're both of them are singer-songwriters, masters of their instruments in their own right. But we've, as many projects as we've all done together, never the three of us at the same time. It's always I'm working with Steve or he's with Sam, or me with Sam and vice versa. So I thought that'd be a good opportunity. Mm-hmm. And not being able to decide which one to do, I decided to go for all of it. And it's really more of a retrospective. It's songs from different times in my career and you know, the albums that we've done together, and Tony and I have worked on all these albums in the past. And so I felt like it was a good for someone who's never heard of any of this before, it's a good introductory kind of a thing. And at the same time, for fans that have been listening for a long time, a lot of these songs are in a completely different light, especially the acoustic material. You know, to hear some of those songs that were originally amped up, as it were, you know, like more of a production piece in the studio, like Creole Angel, for example. And so that, you know, it gives them a different interpretation of these songs. And as an overview, I feel pretty good about it. I'm really happy with it.
Man, I can't wait to check. I'm going to listen to this on the way back. Yeah, this is great.
And what's cool on the acoustic material, and we started doing this, we went out on the road to kind of warm up and kind of get a groove going. You know, it is, you know, okay, let's make a live album. We haven't played in 2 months.
Right.
that's not a good idea. So we were out playing shows, and I did all of my work is on a resonator guitar, and then Steve played accordion, and Sam played his Martin parlor guitar. It sounds incredible. Brian played the cajon, so in lieu of the drum kit, he's sitting on the cajon, you know, the Latin percussion instrument. You hit one side of it, so it's kind of like a kick drum. You hit the other side, there's a snare inside, and get a bit of the snare, and he had a few cymbals and trinkets and little things to tap and hit. So that created a lot of space, and I think that's what really helped all the acoustic instruments to breathe more. And Dave played the ukulele bass. I fell in love with that thing. He brought it to the studio on the last album, Bound by the Blues, and we ended up using it like 4 tracks.
I think I saw Hutch, that plays with Bonnie Raitt, had one too recently.
Oh, it's getting to be the thing now. Everybody, because of the composite strings, it sounds kind of like an upright, but not.
Right.
And it's cool when you see this little bitty thing plugged in. It has this huge sound. So that's really cool. I thought that helped as far as interpreting some of those old songs, and did some old blues covers that I kind of grew up learning how to play on. And I think that's one thing that makes us stand out and pretty special. And to have, like we do with the shows, to start out with the acoustic set, take a short break and come out and amp it up, then it was more dynamic that way.
I love that shot, man, on the back.
That's pretty cool.
It looks
huh?
like some old 70s kind of. Really
and we
cool
did all
shot.
That here at the ACA Theater, Acadia Center for the Arts, and which is a few blocks from here.
Yeah,
made sense because Tony's here and all his gear, his studio. I was
also Tony went
here.
And did remote recording. Mobile.
Yeah, now here's the deal. So our friend, we called up Larry at API, Larry Dropa. We've gotten to be real good friends over the years, and I've been using API for Bobby Phil, R.S. Fields, wanted to turn me onto it in the studio.
Is that what you use on your reprise on the record?
Yeah, always. Yeah, that's my main. Man. I have a lunch box, they call it. Mm-hmm. And it's the vintage, you know, API 312 mic card, 550 A tone.
The 512 or whatever they are. Is that what they are, tone?
550 A is a B. Yeah, 550 A EQ. So anyway, I call up Larry, and we, you know, Tony was setting up his diagram to figure out all his inputs and how we're going to do all this, and between everything he has and a little bit I have, and Brian, our drummer, and then Sam Broussard, he's got his own, you know, mics and stuff. They're real cool. And so I called up Larry, and I asked him, and I said, well, you know, we're just a, Tony says we're a few mic pre's and EQ's short, and he always offered to help, you know, on an album or anything like that. I said, what would you think about maybe loaning him a few, you know, less a few mic pre's and EQ's? And he says, well, how about this? Said, how about I send down this 48 channel console that you two just finished their live album?
Holy shit.
So really? He had the whole thing, you know, crated up, freighted down here, and from outside of Maryland, Annapolis, outside of Annapolis, Maryland. And the only thing I had agreed to is that no one erased the Edge's name on the mask. You know, put the mask and tape down. Everybody has their faders, you know, and the Edge had his. And so when it arrived here, apparently had plexiglass. He'd already screwed in.
Wow!
But it's so cool. So Tony had his world set up in the wings of the theater in this venue. And it really made for a really unique experience. And I knew people would be milling in and out of there, you know. It's Lafayette, Louisiana, you know, security wasn't so great, but that's okay. So kind of a little party vibe going on there.
I can't wait to hear it now even more.
Well, then we had our world on stage with the monitors, and then I had my front of house engineer. He came in and was work and did that for the house. So we had kind of a multi-dimensional experience, and we recorded three nights and took the best of that, and that's recorded live in Lafayette, and also vinyl, man. We did Jim Demain, my mastering engineer, we've worked for many, many years in Nashville, and he mastered separately for, because a lot of people do, they just take their digital masters and make vinyl and it sounds like crap. But he had a separate chain. He, you know, loosened up on the limiting, and so that they could do all that when they're cutting the lacquers at the plant for vinyl. So I'm real excited about that. It looks great.
Yeah, I'll bet on that back. Looks like some big fat old analog film thing.
Yeah, that's cool. Huh?
Yeah,
I love it.
You when you, because you know a lot about equipment and gear and things like that, even probably I guess back when you were working with Zachary, it was pretty minimal and simplistic, but you've always gotten great guitar sounds. I mean, where did you learn about all that stuff, like amp combinations? Is it just a trial and error kind
of
thing?
just plugged in and started playing and trying different things, and I had the advantage of when I was a kid, I actually started recording pretty young, and that came about because my older brother Steve would bring people over. He didn't want them to hear me play, and I couldn't play anything to sit down and play for somebody like a song.
Yeah,
and I had a couple of early bad experiences with that. There was a party my parents were at, and they all wanted to hear me play.
Oh no.
Oh, it was horrible, man. Fortunately, everyone in the room was drunk. all the folks are drunk, and I'm in a sweaty bus.
Play a slide solo, Sonny.
My dad comes and says, "I don't want you to worry." He's so sweet. "I don't want you to worry about it now. They're all in there. They've all been drinking. You're going to do just fine."
It's just going to be like when you grow up.
set me up for my whole career, you know. And I'm 16 years old. I'm probably 15, 14 at that point. But that pushed me to start being prepared. So I started, I got a reel-to-reel, you know, for Christmas. I taught my folks into that. And there's an early Panasonic that you could do sound on sound and sound with sound.
Mm-hmm.
So you could record in one channel and, you know, run the output from that channel into the other and stack them. And so I started making, I had a little repertoire of songs. So when somebody, my brother, bring them over, I said, well, okay, here we go. And I could sit down and have my backing
pre-production.
Tracks. And then my pre-production. That's when it all started.
Of course, you didn't know what it was called then.
No, I had no clue.
Yeah.
I had no clue at all. but that's how I got started recording and to begin experimenting. I mean, all we really had back then, when the first fuzz tone came out, the Maestro fuzz tone.
Yeah.
I brought that thing home. We brought the Echoplex home. After the Echoplex, that was never the same. That was, to me, that was just the most...
It's still
incredible
pretty incredible sounding.
Yeah, I still have them.
That first Van Halen album, that Echoplex, man. Is that what you used on Outward Bound, that slapback? Is that an Echoplex?
I had a... my Echoplex was in the process of dying during the track. It was a bummer. But we got a couple others being in Nashville, and I was able to finish out the track, overdub. You know, maybe we just... ran it through. I think that's what we did.
Because there's a picture of you like dialing in some stuff.
That's it. Yeah. That's Macroplex. And then I used that. I took that on the road with me. With Clifton. I had all of those gigs with him. And then the early stuff with Zach. At one point, and actually on through the part of the 80s with a band I had called Bayou Rhythm. At one point, it crashed and couldn't find anyone to work on it. And by then, pedals were coming out. I could put in my guitar case. So once again, practicality wins over the hump.
Yeah, sure. Well, the Dynacomp, I mean, I don't really usually talk gear, but since you're here, people are going to say, you're sitting with Sonny Landreth to ask him about, you know. So when did you get your first compressor? Because that's a good... component for slide
that was
playing,
another
right?
big moment. That was I was working with Gigi Shin, who's a great singer from down here, and he had quite the name, and he's still singing.
Yeah.
He's an incredible singer, you know, G. So I got in this band, and we travel a lot, and this would have been in right before I started playing with Clifton, actually, in like 77 or 8 maybe. And we'd play six nights a week and did that for a year. And somewhere during that early on, in the beginning of that, I was in a local music store. No, you know what it was? I loved the sound that Larry Carlton had on the Crusaders. And I read in a Guitar Player magazine interview how he plugged into his MXR Dynacomp into his Marshall. It's 335 into Dynacomp to the Marshall. And I said, well, I got to check that out. So I got one, got it at a local music store, took it out. I think we were playing in Morgan City. I still remember this. And I plugged into it. And at first, it's like I couldn't play. I wasn't used to having all the space taken
up. Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? So it was limiting, but it was also bringing everything up in between where I would be like breathing, you know? And all of a sudden, that's like...
It's like skating or something.
Yeah, it really was, and it freaked me out. And I go to hold notes up, but I go to sustain a note and then just bloom, and I go, oh, well, that was cool.
Yeah.
Okay, I got to keep working on this. So I got hooked. It was hard at first, so it was awkward. But once I got used to it, and I was hooked. And that was basic approach for a long time.
And the Dynacomp was a long time.
Yeah,
I don't know if you remember, it was a long time ago. Robert Keeley had asked me if I knew you. I said, yeah, I know Sonny a little bit. And he goes, I want to get him one of my compressors.
And he did.
I got him.
I have you to thank for that.
Yeah, well, I said, I'll send it to me and I'll get it to Sonny. Or I said, do you mind if I give him your address or something?
And
that was a long time ago.
That's when he had
those three knob or two knob, whatever they are. They're still a great compressor. I still use mine.
Yeah, I'd used that for a long time. And they're all, you know, it's like how to use it, knowing when to use it and so forth. I tend to turn them on and leave them on and find a sweet spot so that it
doesn't over squash things.
Yeah.
And still be really dynamic. Always, yeah. But I tell you, it's great for clean tones when you're playing solo pieces. Mm. Speaking of like finger style, like Chet, but that kind of approach. That way you can, I like an even sound from top to bottom so that when you're playing the melody, but you still have articulation on the low end on alternate picking.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's great for that, to even that out. Too much, though, you just lose all the dynamics. And
It's a fine line. I remember the day I came over when you played on my solo record. You played on a track. It was actually across the street. We recorded across the street. And you had, some kind of some kind of compressor, and it sounded like the amp was on fire. It just sounded amazing. I don't know what it was.
Well, if it wasn't the, it was probably the, at that point, that would have been the, Mike Piera, probably Analog Man.
Yeah.
Probably was, because I started using those.
He makes good stuff, too.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, one more thing I want to ask you about. A lot of people don't realize you wrote this song. If you're Neville Brothers fans, you co-wrote Congo Square.
Congo Square, yeah.
Which I played it a million times with those guys, and we'd never get the turnaround right because it would always be, I don't know, they changed it or something. Charlie changed it, but what does it go to, like a flat six thing or something? The turnaround?
When the walk
is it
up?
A G minor?
It's in D minor.
D minor. And yeah, we used to do it in G.
Well, my girlfriend at the time, she was from New Orleans, and we were living here. This was back in early 80s, 80, 81, 82. And she would always talk about Congo Square. And that got me thinking about it and kind of doing a little history on it. And that's, I got inspired about to write the song. And the truly interesting thing, and this is how synchronicity works, and I believe in that sort of thing. I was actually thinking of the Neville Brothers. I thought, you know, this could be a good song for them. And at the same time, I was influenced by a song called Force of Nature by John Mayall. And it was one of those songs that gets in your repertoire, so when you go to jam with somebody, you pull it out.
Right.
And I was afraid that I'd ripped him off, so I went back and listened to it, and it was nothing like it. I was thrilled. But it's funny how, you know, in your mind, it started in one place, and after 15 years or something, you know, it's totally evolved into something different.
Yeah.
Rhythmically. And I came up with that. And fast forward to many years later, both of them ended up doing it. And that's how I met Bobby Field, my producer for many years. He was producing John Mayall's album, A Sense of Place. And Bobby wanted to do two of my songs. And so I flew out to L.A., and that's how I met John Mayall and worked with him. And then the Neville Brothers cut. So
wow.
Just to show
nice,
you,
man.
You never know.
In the distance, sung in the old folks up the bayou, say a prayer. That's when them voodoo people gather, and they play their drums at night in Congo Square.
Can I play you that acoustic real quick? And I'll just use this mic. Thanks, man.
The thing most people do, they play it all minor, which works fine, you know. But actually, the one's the only minor chord. And the four and the five are major, but they're ninth chords. And then the turnaround is a walk up. It's really a four chord with what, when I learned in school, the old saying was first inversion. You put the third in the bass. So if you have the
third bass, you go to the
G chord with the B in the bass.
Yeah.
You walk up a whole set with the A chord with the C sharp in the bass. And then the riff is. And this works too. You know, the old riff in like Hot Tamale Baby Clifton did and Muddy Waters there. But if you play that, man. So it fits. So that fits on floats over the top, nice. You know, six, minor six, and then flat five.
And then the turnaround chords are what?
So there
what
you go. Sure.
Okay.
See, that's how I'm more likely. Let me see it real quick.
I don't know. I've never learned the real thing. We never did that. With ARPA. No. Oh, I see. Yeah.
But an octave up. Mm-hmm. I can't hear my Martin here. Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's the original.
And we cut it in the studio.
That was in 84. We even put it out in 85. Then recut it in 95 for South of I-10 with Mark Knopfler on guitar and Alan Toussaint on piano.
Wow.
And so we just reinterpreted the whole thing so that each of us had a verse, and the playing was like about what that verse was.
It was
like Snake Dance. Mark did all these real snaky lines, and you know, it's really cool, the outro on that thing. It's one of my favorite things that ever happened.
Thank you. like the kind you carry on in Congo Square. Congo Square.
Yeah. Well, man, that about says it all right there, Sonny.
Yeah, my most out-of-tune version today.
Well, this is, you know, there's a natural chorusing effect. I think that's great, man. Thank you so much again for
your time. Yeah, we don't need no blue
chorus, pedal. No, we don't need
no... We didn't get addicted to no blue chorus.
We ain't addicted to any of that. Well, thanks again for doing this, man.
It's my pleasure, Shane. I think it's awesome you're doing it.
Thanks.
Congratulate you on all your success and
your gig.
And all. That's just great, man. Beautiful work.
I just want to be like you when I grow up. You know, that's what I tell people in my podcast. It's like, you guys are doing your own stuff.
Well, growing up's got nothing to do with it, but
yeah, let's not grow up.
I appreciate it.
And thank you, Tony Daigle.
Tony Daigle, my man. Okay, now Tony, get to work. Let's tune those vocals.
Actually, for once, it's my guitar. Does a string go that flat?
Thanks so much for listening. If you're still here, you're a trooper. Hope you enjoyed it and maybe learned some new things about Sonny. I know I did. As always, love your reviews and comments on iTunes. Your ratings helps the thing move up the charts. Let's see what else. The tune you're listening to now is from my solo record called Dirty Power, and this is a tune called Mr. Ed, and that's Sonny and myself playing on it, Jim Keltner and Hutch Hutchison. So if you like Sonny, might want to check that out. Opening track was from Outward Bound. I played some stuff off his new Live from Lafayette. A couple things from South of I-10 and a John Hiatt tune, Memphis in the Meantime, live version. See you next time.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's C-O-R-I-E-N-T.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.